If you like what you're hearing on the Security Ledger podcast, consider subscribing to one of our newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can learn more and sign up at securityledger.com/subscribe. This is the Security Ledger podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 140, we continue our series on the future of passwords as we are joined by Phil Dunkelberger, the president and CEO of Knock Knock Labs. Knock Knock is a pioneer in driving the adoption of passwordless next-generation authentication that includes biometrics, tokens, or wearable-based authentication of devices and users on platforms including mobile, PC, and the Internet of Things. Phil Dunkelberger has a long history in the authentication and data security space. He served for 8 years as the co-founder and CEO of PGP Corporation until it was acquired by Symantec in 2010. He's been an entrepreneur in residence at Dahl Capital Management, served as the president and CEO of Embark and COO of Vontiv Corporation. In this conversation, Phil and I talk about the pandemic of stolen usernames and passwords and how that is forcing a conversation about the need for stronger authentication. To start out, I asked Phil about the movement towards passwordless security, including FIDO, Fast Identity Online, which is a protocol that Knock Knock helped develop and launch.
Philip Dunkelberger, President and CEO of Knock Knock Labs. What Knock Knock Labs does is it's a fundamental way of going about offering modern authentication to the world. And what that really means is today the internet is still working on a 50-year-old idea of username and passwords that need to really go away. And they probably needed to go away for years. Several years ago, we came to the marketplace with an idea that we could build a consortium of companies that would build a new protocol or a new standard handshake for allowing strong authentication to be the new method. And it would bring a couple of key capabilities to the internet as a whole, to both businesses and individuals. Those key elements of design were, one, could we make it a lot easier to use in typing in large numbers of keystrokes on screens or on small screens and in something like a phone or a tablet? So ease of use was paramount. Secondly, could we build a better security model underneath in the plumbing? And we've been able to ultimately do that. The third piece, could we lower the cost of deployment of new types of authentication? Think new types of biometrics that might be coming, things including your heartbeat monitor or something like that that you wanted very discreetly to be able to authenticate with. And then number four, could we ensure global privacy? Privacy has always been a core issue. Being online, it used to really talk about just being tracked. But now privacy seems to follow everything we do, from not only just tracking us online, but our searches online, our banking information online. Our personal lives are really online, and privacy has taken a whole new way of doing it. So four key design areas that we wanted to do when we invented what Knock Knock Labs was set up to do. It created a standard called FIDO, Fast Identity Online. And with that protocol that we provided to industry, we invented the protocol that made it available. We built a consortium of people at the FIDO Alliance that have now agreed that this should be a worldwide standard. And this year, for the first time, the W3C, which governs browsers, to get its mark, will have FIDO built in. So we're finally going to have the ability to do plug and play for strong authentication built in, and we can start moving quickly away from usernames and passwords.
That's actually a huge development, and I'm not sure that most people are aware of it. How might this start to impact people's lives and experiences online, Phil, in the months and years ahead?
The beginning is simple things like account login. One of our first big deployments was in a mobile network operator that some people know is a very cutting-edge company called Docomo in Japan. And Docomo saw the need. They were spending literally millions of yen providing services to phone users. The interesting thing was they didn't think the phones were secure enough, and they certainly were hard to use, because to log into your Docomo account, and this will sound familiar to many of your listeners, you had to provide a username and password, typing with your thumbs on the phone. But then you had to give them an account identifier, usually their customer number, which was 14 characters. And every time you wanted to do something, you had to enter that information over and over again. And their CEO at the time, Kato-san, said to his development team, there's got to be a better way. You know, there's just got to be a better way to do this. So they came to us at Knock Knock Labs and said, you proposed this standard called FIDO. Can we build that into multiple devices and multiple applications? And ultimately, we were able to do that for them. They started out with 4 devices and about 18 applications. Today, they have over 700 applications that you can swipe, touch, take a selfie, or put in a secure PIN as a replacement for those 14 characters in your username and password. So ease of use went up. Account takeover and abandonment is virtually non-existent. And fundamentally, you've got the capability now of providing better and better use cases and more efficient economic use cases for the company. So the company wins and the consumer wins in this particular application.
If our listeners are listening in North America, let's say, might they already be using a FIDO-based service and just not aware of it?
Yeah, some of the people that are using PayPal. PayPal was actually the first instance of FIDO we ever did in a payment system. The second was Alipay. And if you were a Samsung user, you've been using FIDO for a number of years on PayPal if you've been able to use the fingerprint sensor. There's a number of other people that are deploying in North America and globally. We announced the largest bank in Japan for internet banking is now deploying at RSA. SoftBank followed Docomo into the market, providing a lot of goods and services using the FIDO front end that the Knock Knock Lab servers actually do the underlying capability of.
We've had just all of these massive data breaches and collections 1 through 6 or 7 of usernames and passwords. I mean, we're really reaching a saturation point at which pretty much everybody's username and at least one of their passwords is already out there.
Yeah, this pandemic that has gone on of usernames and passwords is incredible. I've been wrong so many times saying it was going to be the year that we finally fixed it as an industry. I quit prognosticating that. And just when you think it can't get any worse, you see it get worse. You look at the data breaches that really have affected people longer term. I was having that discussion this morning with my wife. A simple thing. She was trying to update the car registration of her late father's car for my mother-in-law. And my mother-in-law is afraid of going online because of the data breaches at the DMV. My wife couldn't use her particular credit for this because of the Experian credit issue that was had. So we locked her credit. And you begin to see how these 1 through 6 play with each other. And eventually it gets to the point that people really will start shying away from doing online things because it really has become that much of a hassle.
So talk about the impact of this newest development involving, you know, browsers, you know, using the FIDO standard and kind of really rolling that out to just a massive audience.
Well, if you think about the old way of doing things, you've got something on the endpoint and something in the server architecture that provides the service to you. And I think the world has actually evolved to the point that they're just people with devices looking for services. And they're counting on the people that provide those services to be more successful in protecting their information, their data, and their transactions. So in a world where there are no perimeters anymore, really, and their parameters of use are really trying to provide more and more rich services to people, you've got the people out there today that now have needed a simple way to do it. The biggest problem was always deploying the endpoint. How do we get the endpoint to agree to be able to plug and play something like an authenticator and be able to use it universally? And for the listeners, think about when we started doing Wi-Fi and you had to go buy a dongle and put it in to your device. And in some cases, several dongles, because if you were roaming or in different countries, you had to have different capabilities to go on a standard Wi-Fi network. That has been the history of what's gone on with trying to build strong authentication into older systems. With the FIDO protocol now approved, the endpoint will be deployed in browsers. You can already build it into applications. You now can also build it into browsers. So we've really covered the gamut of use cases at the endpoint. Any browser, any application, any operating system, any device that uses those capabilities will be able to deploy strong authentication. Think anything from a strong secure PIN to the ability to swipe, touch, and selfie. In the biometric area, to future things, like I said earlier, something like your heartbeat, something like a Fitbit device. Those things become another level of strong authentication for you, or second factor of authentication, that's not reliant on a big back end of database and passwords, or reliant on things that hook those things into a database of password systems that are these large targets that have been exploited all these years. So the world is coming, and there's big deployments. We've actually deployed around the world. We have big instances in China, big instances in Japan and other parts of Asia. We have several big announcements we'll make about Africa and Europe, about large-scale deployments that are coming to people. And the real lag, interestingly enough, is in the United States. And that is because a lot of the things like PSD2 in Europe is a banking specification that says if you're going to bank in Europe after this year, you're going to have to provide strong multi-factor authentication as a part of your offering. There will be no SMS anymore. SMS is being deprecated. It's been broken for years. But we in the United States think, hey, that two-factor thing, send me something on my phone, is really cool. Well, in that case, bad breath is sometimes worse than no breath because you think it's secure when it really isn't. And finally, NIST and other people have come out and said, you need to replace SMS and these other older forms of multi-factor authentication that have been spoofed and broken in the world and replace them with something better. And that something better, thank goodness, has been the FIDO specification has been recognized as that something better by both the National Institute of Standards, BSI in Germany, CESG in the UK. All of these people are saying there's a better, more modern way to do strong authentication or multi-factor authentication, and FIDO is the path forward.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think in the US, you know, we're a little bit, I guess, solipsistic. We kind of think that we're just the bee's knees on everything. But actually, if you look at other countries, particularly Asia, countries like South Korea, China, you know, Singapore, Japan, they're far ahead of us in this, both the mobile commerce and also, you know, adoption of biometrics and cashless payments and so on. What do you think is holding the United States back on this? I mean, I know we're enamored of SMS two-factor, but are there bigger issues or challenges that are holding back adoption of it?
Back to the statement of there's no easy plug-and-play method until now. I think that you're pointing out that the W3C, that all browsers to get that mark as a standard will have to support FIDO by the end of the year. That is a great big move forward. One of the things that being part of the industry that I know can be frustrating for people like you and I that have been doing this for a long time is there are better ways forward, but it takes a long time for standards to get actually evolved and get approved. Most people don't understand the machinations that they go through, which is really well designed to help people. You know, we had over 400 different companies as part of the alliance. Most of the big names in the internet around the world, about a third in Europe, a third in Asia, and a third in the United States, making up the FIDO Alliance, trying to bring something better to the computing world. And, you know, for the first time, I think that in a couple of years, we finally got something with the W3C right, where people now have the endpoints deployed and they can now come with better capabilities that run the gamut of different types of applications, not just login. That's what we always think of as authentication as your login, but being able to federate that login to other systems on the back end, being able to play in the overlap of people and IoT. IoT usually is thought of course, as, you know, the idea of machine to machine auth. Well, when we designed FIDO, because, you know, Knock Knock essentially built it, the first one, and put the protocol together, we built it on the idea of machine to machine authentication, which is what IoT's whole idea is about. We've done a bunch of work on top of blockchain and wearables using FIDO as a passive protocol sitting on top. And then as an active protocol, when something like a driverless car breaks down, you know, it's not going to fix itself. Might drive itself, but it's not going to fix itself. And so you've got the overlap of all of these technologies still needing somebody to authenticate themselves and intervene even in the machine-to-machine conversations in IoT.
W3C aside, do you see any impact from state-level data privacy laws like California's, or maybe down the road eventually some kind of federal data privacy and data security law in the U.S.?
You know, I've worked for years, the CSIA and a number of other organizations, CSA. We've been working up on the Hill federally for years. And what that resulted in was 48 states of the 50 with different data breach laws.
Success.
It was massively successful 48 different times, 48 different ways.
Exactly. Yeah, we created many data privacy.
Yeah, we did a great job of convincing people we needed something. That 48-headed monster is now starting to coalesce underneath about things like California looking at GDPR and saying we should have a version of that and we should have bigger, stiffer fines. I think some of that comes out of people kept saying the industry's got to fix these problems through just simply better innovation and somewhat force of will. And when these data breaches continue to happen with, you know, most recently big ones like Experian, where really sensitive information is leaked and can be used, you know, so many different ways, making it really tough for people to go forward. It really says that finally the government is going to continue to hammer people in business that aren't good custodians of data. And all of this revolves around data as currency, and data is traded as currency on the black web and the dark web, and has been for years. Whether it was dumpster diving or anything else to get your personal information,
yeah, right.
You know, this is, you know, what's gone on. And eventually people thought we would fix it, and we haven't. So you're going to see more state regulations. You're going to see more federal regulations. I think you're going to see more specialist regulations coming out of like the banking committees in the federal government. And I think you're going to see something like PSD2 make its way to the United States that says, if you do not have strong multi-factor authentication, which is also in the GDPR of both the state of California and the EU, if you don't have strong step-up authentication, we're not going to let you use that technology anymore. Because again, you know, you think you're safe because you're using some second factor when in itself has been broken.
I know we've talked about, you know, facial scans and obviously fingerprint scans. What should we be looking for in terms of different types of biometrics out there? And I know like on platforms like the iPhone, we've seen maybe a transition in the newer phones from the Touch ID to a face scan. Are device providers and vendors going to try and migrate towards one really good and reliable biometric, or is it likely there will be a choice?
I think there's going to be a longer period of transition than we would have hoped for. FIDO took longer to get out as a standard plug and play than we had planned. And I think now you're going to see with the W3C uptake, there's going to be more opportunity. I think people will start with touch and facial recognition because those are out there today. I think voice has been the one that we hear the most. Integration, we already have integration of FIDO and our products at Knock Knock to call centers. But people want that more on the operational side at the endpoint. So I think voice is a coming capability that's going to be more used.
Mm-hmm.
Behavioral biometrics seems to be the new shiny penny for your listeners, which is how do I type? How do I swipe? How do I hold my phone? Those ideas are out there. You've got biometrics, physical biometrics, shape of my ear, how I hold my ear against the screen. You've got pressure touch types of things on the screen and again on keys. So it's a number of things. There's talking about DNA biometrics where, you know, lick your finger and swipe the screen and there'll be a DNA sensor. Literally there's things that, like that. Yeah. It's getting to the point where the sensors are so cheap and becoming so ubiquitous.
You're logged in and your cousin is a serial killer.
Yeah, exactly. We looked in the database and didn't realize that we were employing a serial killer. That's not a good thing. The idea really undergirding really who's there. You know, the old joke about how we named the company wasn't a joke at all. It's what our product does. It really links the person to the device, to the service, right? That's what we built. And the idea of Knock Knock, who's there, is really what we've been trying to do. And back to your point, that area of the perfect storm that's formed up about legislation that's here or coming around the world, about use cases that are here or coming, plays right into how many different ways could we find to identify the person that's holding the device at the endpoint. But if you think about that, and you think about how for years we've fed devices, essentially dumb devices, with really actionable information, wouldn't you rather have the right components delivered to the person when they're online at that time, i.e. the right content for the right person in that moment? You can do that when you really understand who's actually at the keyboard or on the phone at the time you're delivering goods and services. That's when you can get into real-time help. You can get into really efficiencies that you've never had before. But until now, you know, I'm still getting ads because I bought my wife perfume 3 years ago at a major department store, and they continue to send me perfume ads every day, all day, because that's what they do with ads. That takes up bandwidth.
Yeah.
It's a waste of everybody's time. It's the only people that are benefiting are the click-throughs that you get if I inadvertently click on it. And that's not an economy. That's actually just a waste of time. So this ability to really know who's there is going to fundamentally change the way we can deal with each other in the ether because we know it's not a dog on the internet anymore.
You know, one of the real challenges we see is that paradoxically, the countries that are the most advanced in these areas are often some of the most repressive. So, you know, you look at the government of China, for example, which, you know, is doing amazing things with biometric identification. And some of those, you know, filter through to e-commerce and have, you know, positive social and economic benefits. But some of them are harnessed by the state to, you know, further repressive policies. And, you know, certainly in a country like the United States or other Western democracies, there is this kind of tug of war between the desire for more accurate authentication and the concern about how biometric data might be misused or abused by, again, repressive regimes or even just unscrupulous companies. How do we square that circle, as it were?
Well, I think that that's part of the innovation that we brought with FIDO as an example. We don't collect your biometric templates. They're never stored anywhere than on the device, and they're stored securely in the execution environment on the device. They're just stored in hardware. So the keys that are generated, FIDO is based on a public-private key challenge, not shared secrets as the old systems were. And the data that's collected, your keys essentially, I like the metaphor of going home at night. You don't go home at night and hand your identifying keys to your car, your house, your safes, to your next door neighbor. FIDO was built on that premise that all of your private identifiers stay on your local device and they stay encrypted in hardware on the device, the best thing we know how to do today. The best security, public-private key pairs, are what we used to do the challenges to set up the communication channel that FIDO uses. So these identifiers are strong identifiers of you and your device and your services, but they're not easily cracked by, you know, governments listening in because there's nothing to store. The only thing that gets stored on the service is a public key, and that's useless without you, the service, the transaction, and if you used a biometric, the biometric, all those other high bars to crack one FIDO transaction. So, for instance, phishing, right. You know, it's the idea of account takeover and phishing with FIDO. The reason we built it with all of this industry input is if you go to PayPal and you get a phishing link to click on this PayPal link that's not PayPal, the device is going to tell you there's no corresponding public key for me to talk to. So it's obviously not PayPal you're talking to. And this is the idea about it being built into the infrastructure, that things that the user does not have to worry about anymore. Industry is working hard to put this standard in so you can plug and play and make it life without passwords, you know, coming to the future. If you look at the privacy issues, yeah, they're a big supporter. China has its own FIDO working group as an example. And they're a big supporter of using Western standards, but they use their own ciphers in FIDO, meaning Chinese ciphers, not Western ciphers. And that's their call. Mm-hmm. You know, that's their legality call of what the Chinese government does. So we can't dictate from a technology standpoint. We can raise the bar. First, we had, you know, really no security, right, by and large, out there for consumers. Hey, get on the internet and it's a free-for-all. Then we started having, you know, big problems with data breaches around the world. And people said, hey, companies, we're going to fine you, you know, up to and including now GDPR, a whole bunch of money if you don't put some security in. So they put the best security in and that they can find, right? And it's like, wait a second. Now we can't, you know, law enforcement can't, you know, break into these phones because you've encrypted them. Well, we encrypted them because you were fining us for losing people's data, right? Best practices was to secure them. So we've got to come to this realization that as we innovate and go forward, there's going to be a balance. And something Phil Zimmerman used to say I've always appreciated. When people say, we've got somebody's phone that's a criminal and we have information on it, I first want to say is, well, how'd you know they were a criminal? In the real world, people leave fingerprints other than just what's on their phone or their laptop. And I totally support the fact that if you can get into those devices, you know, you go get a warrant, you do it legally, you do it the right way, and you find people that are doing bad stuff and that's great. And if they've taken the ability to encrypt and do those things, encryption itself isn't just the problem. You know, do you outlaw people having computers? Do you outlaw people having phones? Because you need all those things to be able to drive use of encryption. So it's a tough area for both law enforcement and for people that are trying to protect their information. But we have to find a balance between being able to whisper on the internet and being surveilled and taken advantage of on the internet. And that is it's a tough line to walk. And, yeah. and fundamentally, having been through that for a long, long time, I certainly support the right for law enforcement to properly go about and get information on people. That's why we have courts and rules of law. But fundamentally, what you do want to have is the ability, if you've got sensitive data, personal information, business information on your machines, intellectual property, you want the ability to keep those private and secure until a court tells you you can't.
One issue that you have weighed in on, I think is a really interesting one, is the need to not only shore up authentication, use better, more secure authentication, but also on the flip side to police and crack down on fake identities and just the ability of malicious actors or hostile governments or whatever to forge completely fictitious identities that are then used to authenticate or used to further access to sensitive information. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think that this idea of synthetic identity has become a major play. You know, we rely on the things that we see in front of us, back to authenticating, things we see that we think are true. And you get on your Facebook page and suddenly you have a friend that's feeding you information about something that you knew nothing about. And it becomes a truism in your life because it's a trusted introducer of that information. When the person actually feeding that information to you is not a friend of a friend at all. And you know, we've seen a lot of that in the idea that they were meddling in our democracy. And no matter what side you take on who was involved in that, if it in fact did happen, and it happened through mechanisms that people trust, you've really got to ask the people supplying that to do a much better job of finding out who created this account, who owns it, and what are they doing with it. And you know, I know that that plays into other areas, but if you start just with disinformation campaigns, you know, that's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is synthetic information, where I go and steal information and I create a synthetic identity and I go out in the world and buy and sell things in somebody else's name. Okay, that's sure. Classic, you know, what happens in a data breach consequently to somebody. And we've all probably had some of that happen in the last few years. A third way that is really, really, to me, becoming more nefarious is the idea that I bought a product and I'm raiding or killing somebody else's product when I didn't buy a product at all. I'm a competitor with a synthetic identity that is stolen information that says, I'm going to go on your website and write scathing reviews or go on social media about your products. When in fact, I don't even use your product. I'm a competitor running you down in the media or socially and being attributed as being a buyer and user of your product that had a negative experience. All these things deal with this idea of synthetic identity, misinformation, misuse. And I don't think a lot of times we're tough on calling it. You know, I've always joked that John Callis, our CTO at PGP, now working, had worked at Apple, but John's now with the ACLU. John has always been very clear to people, you shouldn't call things cute names on the internet. It shouldn't be phishing. People aren't phishing. They're stealing from you. It's a criminal activity. Mm-hmm. And we're not hard enough on people to say, these things are really unacceptable in this new world that we're in. And those of people have a super negative effect. And I think synthetic identity theft and synthetic identity posturing is one of the more nefarious things that we've run into in a long time on the internet.
Is the solution then to have a kind of what some countries are proposing, sort of a real name policy where everybody is just themselves online and you can't adopt handles or maintain multiple accounts? You know, you must only be yourself.
I think that there's a thing that you can argue, and it's been argued fairly, I think, in some places, that you can say for certain types of transactions, if it's not you, you're breaking the law from the get-go. If you're setting up accounts to do things badly, you know, banking accounts and things to transact, where it needs to be you, there needs to be proof of ability that it's you. I think that there's certain classes of things, that, and that's why we built FIDO the way we did. Know who's there, right? Technology can help with this. Technology can give people a clue that who they're dealing with really is who they want to be dealing with. The flip side is you know, I get asked all the time, you know, is it okay to surf anonymously on the web? Is it okay to search anonymously on the web? Is it okay to do certain things? Talking about 85, you know, 90% of the people just doing searches, they should be able to go search for, you know, whatever they're searching for and not have somebody tracking them and marketing to them and selling to them or doing other things with that information, right? The flip side is, you know, if you're breaking the laws in what you're doing, there should be some accountability for what you do online. Just like you can't go into a theater, free speech is great, but you can't go into a theater and yell fire, right? And create a disturbance at that level. What I'm not in favor of is one size fits all. And unfortunately, the legalities of the internet have not caught up with the technology. We've been trailing since its introduction.
Yeah.
And they still haven't caught up.
Well, there's a real technology literacy gap between policymakers and the technology community, obviously. And I think that's been shown many a time.
Phenomenal point, and an issue that goes back to, we have a lot of people. People ask me one of the biggest things. They say, Phil, what is one of the biggest things? You've been in the industry 40 years, started your career back with Xerox introducing Ethernet and ease of use, things like mice and windows as a conveyance of how to look at data. And all the years you've been doing this, you know, through your career, what are the things that you've seen? And it's many, many times it's a Luddite syndrome, you know, that work is a four-letter word and nobody wants to do it. It's hard work to make this stuff work just to begin with. It really is tough on the IT organizations, CISOs, CIOs organizations to just keep the businesses up and running, providing goods and services. What's even tougher is when you get legislation and legislators from around the world, the body politic around the world that doesn't even understand how this stuff works. And they want to paint everything in very simple, easy ways of solving the problem. And there's times I've been on both sides watching two sides of the aisle argue with each other and walk away going, it would be great if you guys even understood what you were arguing over, let alone the argument itself.
We talk a lot, discuss a lot on Security Ledger podcast of security challenges related to the Internet of Things. Talk to us about some of the IoT applications and implementations of FIDO and Knock Knock's technology. What types of use cases are we seeing?
Yeah, one of the user journeys I like to talk about is a call center, pretty common thing that everybody interacts with at some point, fortunately or unfortunately in their lives, is calling into a call center. And we were talking to a very large mobile network operator, and we'd work with them on login, account login. And they said, well, you know, what else do you guys do? And I said, well, you can use the phone as a token in a IoT capability. And me and the technical team worked with them on employee comes to the door, swipes his fingers, takes a selfie, and the door opens. At that time, there's the key is then federated in the background to that employee's call center station that day. So the scheduling system then gives him a note, essentially a text note that says, you're in section 3, you know, computer 1 today. That's where you're working, and you're going to be supporting the EU. While he's walking, making his way, or she's making way to that workstation, it automatically loads all of the tool sets they need to work in that and the customers they'll be working with. So by the time they get within range of that workstation, it's already ready to go. And then as they walk up to it, using the phone as a token where you've already logged into it, you've logged into the device, the device is now working, logging you into systems. That then logs you into your device and you sit down and go to work. You get up to take your break, you go down to the cafeteria, you pick up your snacks, you walk through. Your phone automatically bills and pays. You never have to take your wallet or your purse with you down there. Just take your phone, which most people do. You get back to your workstation, do your job. Wow. At the end of the day, you walk out. When you leave the building is, your device is geofenced at your workstation, and the building is geofenced. You walk out, it logs you out, updates all the logs, and the next person is ready to go, clears the machine, and the next person that's coming in on the 7x24 support walks in, and the same process happens. They're saving somewhere between 20 minutes and an hour of just people's time logging in and out of systems. And it's all machine to machine in the background. So you're the human being logs in, and from that point, device to device takes over for you and does a lot of the tasks that computers are really good at, which is repetitive tasks being done over and over again. That's one example of a human interacting with a fully enabled FIDO environment in IoT. Door locks, machine devices, databases, routers, all of those things coming together in one instance of using IoT plus the human interface to it. Yeah, think of a world where you're roaming around with your devices, and your devices are doing the strong authentication login because you've strongly authenticated to the device. It can now strongly authenticate to supported back-end systems.
Phil Dunkelberger, CEO of Knock Knock, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Phil Dunkelberger is the president and CEO of Knock Knock Labs. He was here to talk with us about the movement towards passwordless authentication.